from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today, Matt Sosi joins us for an interview with musician Tad Robinson. Then I get a taste of this year's Greek Fest.
Speaking of food, I'll talk with Kira Amstutz from the Indiana Humanities Council about an evening with two very special chefs. It is part of the Food for Thought theme, Spirit and Place Festival. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Singer and harmonica player Tad Robinson has a new album called Back in Style. His mixture of soul and blues has made him a global draw on the blues festival circuit. Matthew Sosi, host of the Blues House Party, spoke with Robinson about the new album.
First time I heard Back in Style, the first cut obviously is Rained All Night, and there was the whirling organ playing of one Kevin Anker, and I heard it and I had a big grin because I immediately thought, that's a Willie Mitchell move. That's a move that starts an Al Green tune.
Yeah, we definitely are influenced by High Records sound on this particular record, and Willie Mitchell, being a famous producer at High Records, you know, was so influential to all people who play soul music and blues, and I guess it just creeped in there. But Kevin Anker handles the keyboards on the record, and he did a great job. And yeah, Rained All Night's kind of we like it as an album opener because it's kind of got that inviting organ sound.
Now,
kicks the record off.
Was the album finished before Willie passed or after? First thing was wondering
right
if there
around,
was a tribute.
It wasn't really a conscious tribute, other than that. The Willie Mitchell High Record sound is really the holy grail for soul music. So it would be difficult not to, you know, be touched by that and influenced by his sound, you know, with the great artists like Ann Peebles and Otis Clay and Al Green, Syl Johnson, all the artists that recorded for High. So the label I'm on, Severn, definitely takes a lot from that old style. But I can't remember the chronology. I think we were finished with the record before Willie Mitchell passed on.
Have you ever been to High?
I have not.
I've talked with Dan Holmes about this. I passed by it once when I was in Memphis. Little nondescript with a little, mm-hmm. you know, little sign. And, you know, I knocked on the door. I was touring Stax. And I went, it was like 11 o'clock. Cool. 11 o'clock in the morning. Nobody was there. But there it was.
Wow.
That's where all of this amazing music was created.
Yeah, amazing treasure of American music right there. It's amazing. That's great.
So so tell us about recording this one. How was this one compared to your previous work, whether it be Severin or Delmark?
Well, it's a continuation of the other, the other records. We've done three for Severin, so we did one record in 04 and then another in 08, and then this one in a lot of 09, and it was released now in 10. And just the same crew of musicians, but with the addition of the Memphis Horns. So, and I have to admit that they added a lot of really interesting horn parts, very simple, but just really appropriate. Wayne Jackson, the trumpet player from the Memphis Horns, was the guy who kind of came into the studio, listened to our tracks, and then just started fiddling with the trumpet and would say, okay, I'm going to go in there. And he would play a line, and then the trombone player and the baritone player would unison what Wayne came up with. So they'd come down with one pass in unison. So it was just an interesting way of approaching the stuff, and I really think that he did a great job on a lot of the section work. So that's the difference. It's the same band as my other two records, but with a different horn section. And it was a lot simpler. Willie Henderson was the arranger on the previous albums, and he did a lot of work with Tyrone Davis, the mm-hmm. Shy Lights. He even did Eli Paperboy Reed's recent record.
We'll get to him in a bit.
Yeah, so another of the more modern soul singers Willie's working with also. But anyway, Willie Henderson did horns and strings on my previous albums, but this time we decided to see if Wayne Jackson and his folks from Memphis would come. And so it's got a little different flavor, given that it's a different horn section and a different approach. Willie is very embellished and ornate, and he puts a lot of, you know, a lot of really groovy ideas and melodies over the tracks, whereas Wayne Jackson just came up with very simple parts, which, when you listen to High records and Stax, that's the way a lot of those records were. It was just a little bit, you know.
Was Wayne familiar with your work?
No, but he sure did become familiar, you know. And he had, truth be told, I was not there, so I never met the Memphis Horns, because we cut the tracks, and then David Earl, my producer, said that he was bringing them in. He offered for me to fly out to be there, but, you know, people have busy schedules and families and stuff, and I didn't want to fly back.
You didn't try dropping that nugget to your family?
Yeah,
talk,
right.
Honey, can I fly out? Because Wayne Jackson.
You know, sometimes you just have to pass on. You can't take every opportunity. I would have liked to have been there, but, you know, who knows? Maybe I would have been in the way. Sometimes fewer bodies in a recording studio, you know, the better, you know. Too many cooks spoil the stew, as they
say. As the song says.
You know, and yeah, these cats knew what they wanted to do, and I would have just been, you know, I would have liked to have been a fly on the wall and just gotten his autograph or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right about Wayne and the Memphis Horns. First off, you know, they're music history of any genre, but yeah, they're able to hit a couple of simple, you know, musical punches just mm-hmm. to add to the song itself.
I thought it was really appropriate. They played on, I think they're on nine of the tracks of the 11 we did. And, yeah, I just now a lot of the songs, I can't hear them without their parts. It's not that they added they added new parts rather than just embellishing parts that were already there, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, they came up with different thematic things that really made the tunes somehow come together in a new way. It was really interesting to me.
Now, you mentioned, how often do you get the chance to play with the horn section? Because I remember you had the CD release party at the Kitchen,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, horn guys are extra.
Yeah, I don't get to do it enough. The funny thing is we're more apt to do it when we're on the road in Europe or something, where the festivals that we work when we're playing abroad, a lot of times they want the entire package. For instance, if they hear a new CD, they want to hear that CD as they don't want to hear a stripped down version of it. They say, hey, we want this.
Or a 30-minute version of it.
Yeah, I mean, they want, you know, so if there's horns on the record, then they're willing to foot the bill for a horn section. So like you say, yeah, that's extra. And not every band in the States can afford to bring, you know, a large-scale production like that, particularly in R&B, blues, jazz. Heck, anymore, bands are coming, showing up with one guy and a synth or something, you know, sequencer. No.
You at least bring yeah. Kevin Anker.
At least I generally have a quintet. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm lucky to have a great band in Indianapolis
yes.
that so many of your listeners probably know from other contexts or from my band. Paul Holdman on guitar.
Yep.
And a lot of people know him from his association with Jenny DeVoe.
And his own trio.
And Paul Holdman trio. And he is, his work with Jenny DeVoe on her recent record, I can't say enough about it. It's a great disc, and she's a great writer, very top-notch. And so Paul is, you know, I'm lucky to have him on just about all my gigs here in the region. And Kevin Anker, as we've said, on keys, and David Murray on bass, and Jeff Chapin on drums.
Of course.
So if you get spoiled working with guys at that level, and then when they can't make a date, you have to, you know, scurry around and find people to substitute. And that's my new, that's the new thing in my life, that I got to really get other sidemen in this town kind of hip to what I'm doing, so that when those other guys can't make a gig,
right,
I can still show up and play my repertoire, because those guys know about 200 songs that I do.
Mm-hmm.
So if you hire a sub and you go, okay, you want the gig? Well, here's the set list.
Right.
You know, you can only hope that they'll learn 10 or 15 tunes, you know, and then you can fake the rest of the night, but it's hard to fill in.
Now, when you go to Europe, is it just you? I mean, or do you have backup bands in Italy or Scandinavia?
It depends, you know, what kind of opportunity is being offered to me. Generally speaking, though, like, for instance, in October, I'll be in Europe for 3 weeks, and I'll have the band that recorded the disc. You know, I'll have Rob Stupka on drums, and I'll have Steve Gomes, Alex Schultz on guitar, and I'll have Kevin Anker on keys. Generally speaking, they bring my whole quintet.
Mm-hmm.
There is a thing. I'm going to Norway in a couple of weeks, and I'll just be playing with a Norwegian band. They're back. They just basically offered me a slot at this festival. It's an hour, 2 hour sets, you know,
mm-hmm.
one on a Friday, one on a Saturday at the Notodden Blues Festival. It's really one of the biggest blues festivals anywhere. They have about 80 bands over the course of a week in all sorts of different venues all over this town of Notodden, Norway. And, anyway, so I was offered that. So in answer to your question, sometimes European bands will back me
mm-hmm.
With mixed results. I mean, these guys are really good musicians, and I've worked with them before, so they're apt to really learn the tunes from the various discs that I, you know, to make an hour set, you would hope that guys could rise to the occasion and play, what's that, 11, 12 songs and really do them well. So mm-hmm. I think we'll have a good showing, and but that festival's... My understanding was that the Norwegian band I'm working with couldn't get the gig unless they had someone more stature to be involved. So they said, look, can we get this guy, Tad Robinson, that we had worked with before?
Mm-hmm.
That's what the conversation. So then I was asked to do it. So
okay. You mentioned Severin, and I say... I think it's the best way to describe this label based out of Maryland is I think you and I once referred to it as a singer's label, because two of your label mates are two of the finer singers still working out there, Daryl Nulich and Lou Pride, who you grew up with.
Sugar Ray Norcia.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of blues labels or a lot of blues music is about guitar. I mean, I always say, you know, it's when you're working in blues clubs, it's the guitar player's world. We just work here, you know. I mean, people, the guitar, the instrument itself generates a lot of excitement, and in the right hands, it can be, you know, a real virtuosic instrument, and it's exciting, and it drowns out everything else, too. But
you tell Paul that, don't you?
Actually, Paul is a very rare cat. He plays really appropriate and sensitive, and he knows when to, you know, play up, and when he knows how to accompany, but and make room for other instruments. But Yeah, Severn Label pays attention to singers more so than maybe the scene, because the biggest cats on the blues scene, generally speaking, you know, if you think of Buddy Guy, B.B. King, Tommy Castro, Tad Benoit, Joe Bonamassa, Walter Trout, Jimmy Thackeray, Kev Moe, Robert Cray. I mean, you know, I'm just throwing out a few names.
All of them have something in common.
Guitar players, right. You know. So if you're a piano player, if you're a sax player or whatever, or if you're just a singer, you're kind of forgotten oftentimes with the way the blues is marketed. I mean, people don't, they just don't talk about blues singers.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not a term you really hear. You are more apt to hear people talk about blues guitarists.
Right.
You know, Stevie Ray Vaughan was a damn good singer, but most people consider him just a guitar player.
Right.
So that's the world that we live in. Yeah.
Bob Kester once said when people would ask him where to, you know, find music or who did he like, and somebody said, I'm not too crazy about singers, his usual response was, you know what, the singer probably has a damn good guitar player with him or her in that case.
Yeah.
Now there is some harmonica on this. I know there's a little bit of blues. There's some blues flavor and tinges, I guess, on the new album, because I know in the past I've asked you the soul to blues ratio. I'm not going to do that this time around.
I blow harp too, if you know, in case people that are listening to the show aren't aware, a lot of my show is harmonica based blues, but we use it more in the recordings as a color. You know, it's just an instrument that colors between the vocals and stuff. But back to Severn, just one more thing about
sure.
It's really a throwback idea to have a label that is based primarily on blues singers and soul singers. Just, you know, and that trend is coming back a little bit more, because blues singers were more, I mean, back in the history of blues, it was back then, it was all about singing and the words. And it's only been a modern fascination with guitar, I think, that has kind of made it not important about the singing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Severn is, in that respect, Severn Label that I record for is doing, is being a little retro in that regard.
Now, speaking of retro, I would say you are, what's interesting is that you are still, I think, a newbie in the blues world. I think of 97-year-old Pine Top Perkins.
Yeah, true. next to people like that, but I've been around a little bit.
That's true. I would say.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, in the if you want to call it the soul music revival, soul music boom, you're kind of one of the elder statesmen. And a gentleman who we talked about earlier, John Namath, said this to me. He goes, there's one person I'm afraid of on stage, and that's Tad Robinson. So,
John is one of the younger, he's in his 30s.
That's an embryo
business. The blues, not in pop music, but in blues, that's for sure. And John is really a phenom, you know. He's a great singer, great, amazing harmonica player, great songwriter. For him to say that, I mean, he's being kind to me. He's saying that I scare him, because I know that, you know, he's a great performer too.
Oh yeah,
and he'll cut you in any number of ways. I don't want to go on stage with him.
But you might have him on better hats.
Yeah, well, he always wears a suit. I noticed that.
And his band.
Really?
He's got a tight band. I saw them play in Bloomington, but it's interesting seeing these 30, 20-somethings. Andre Williams played at the Chicago Blues Fest, and he was surrounded by these 20-year-olds, you know, in suits, playing this really aggressive R&B.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, then there's Eli Paperboy Reed we talked about, and Sharon Jones. And then there are all the other ones who never really went away. You know,
exactly.
The newbies are, you know, the people who've come around the last 3 to 5 years. Whereas there's still people, I mean, hell,
you can't, sorry.
Heck, Syl Johnson is still around, and it doesn't get any heavier of people who are listening. If you're interested in soul blues, that's all you need. I mean, that's the Desert Island stuff. Syl Johnson's records are the beginning, middle, and end of the story. And he's still around. So it's not like soul blues ever really went away. But these folks are definitely putting a spotlight back on that. So it's pretty cool that people are appreciating that. And it's made its way a little bit into the mainstream. We really need to
set things straight and make the time for just we two. It's in your book, just right in me and you. Way too much, it's just enough. Take all night, no.
Sosi with blues musician Tad Robinson. Robinson's new album, Back in Style, is available on Severin Records. And Matt Sosi's Blues House Party can be heard each Saturday night at 8 p.m. here on WFYI.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. For the second year in a row, Greek Fest will take place in Carmel at the Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church. Travis DiNicola spoke to organizers Mary Lee Pappas and Dean Antonopoulos about the event. And he got to sample some great Greek food, too.
Mary Lee, Dean, welcome to Art of the Matter, and I am so thrilled to have you both in the studio. I love it when guests bring a lot of food with them,
yes.
And it smells so fantastic. This is, like, totally unfair to our listeners at home on, because of the radio. You know, like, you can't have, like, scratch-and-sniff radio. I wish you could, because I have no idea on all the stuff you brought. I'm just going to sniff around and get into that. But let's just start off with sort of the basic stuff. Greek Fest is coming up. That's why you brought all this great food. Greek Fest
right.
is great food, great music, great culture, great fun. And it's been around for 30-some?
This is our 37th annual festival coming up. September 10th and 11th.
That is so cool. So now, and this year it's up at Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church, which is in Carmel, right?
Right, at 106th and Shelburne Road.
Okay. And both Friday evening, September 10th, as well as Saturday the 11th.
Right, Friday evening from 4 to 11, and Saturday from noon to 11.
Okay. Now, I know that there is more than food. I don't see why, actually, just again, as I'm like smelling the stuff you brought, why there needs to be more than food. But what else besides the food takes place at Greek Fest?
Well, we have a live Greek band performing both days throughout the day. We have our own Holy Trinity Hellenic dance troupe from kids of all ages, from kindergarten all the way up to high school and college kids.
Okay.
Performing many of the traditional Greek dances that are around from all over the country.
And a marketplace.
Oh, and the marketplace. Yeah, we have a bazaar that will be have its own separate tent this year, and where people can find everything from jewelry to iconography and artwork.
Okay.
You leave it to the girl to remember the shopping cart.
We have a new item. Speaking of jewelry, I just saw one of the items that we're going to be selling there. It's a Greek key ring. It'll be silver. And what's interesting about this is it actually spins around the ring. So it's hard to describe without seeing it. We're on the radio, so that,
no, I can kind of picture that, though. But it's sort of like ring, two pieces, and the yeah, one spins on
right,
top of the other?
Exactly.
Excellent.
It's really cool.
So, Mary Lee, how'd you get involved with Greek Fest?
How did I get involved? Well, once upon a time in 1973, when I was 3 years old, it's the 37th year for the Greek Fest, as we
right.
said. I'm a lifelong parishioner, but unlike Dean, I'm not good at going to church. You know, every week Dean is immersed in the church. Just growing up in a Greek household,
yeah.
you know, Greek culture really revolves around
food and music.
Food, culture, music. It revolves around the faith also, mm-hmm. the Orthodox faith. And really, I always see Greek Fest as an extension of you know, what was happening in my home and my family anyway, even though I'm half Greek. My mom is not Greek. My dad was first generation. He'd be 90, and music played a huge part every day in our lives. I never didn't know, you know, my Greek dances that I can't pronounce, like Syrto and Chamaka, and some of the wonderful dances that everyone who attends can come out and dance and have fun, whether you know the steps or not. The music is just so great. So I really just feel like it's an extension of the community, you know, just really a big old party for everybody
Absolutely.
To feel a little Greek.
For everyone to feel a little Greek.
Yeah.
And Dean, you're a first generation, right?
Yes, I am. Both my parents are from Greece, and I had to grow up in the Greek restaurant business because they are Greek, and as first generation, as they came off or came into this country, my dad was originally a Mason and was working part-time after his regular job in a restaurant, and then got into the restaurant business itself, and he did this.
And this is Hellas Cafe?
No. We had our restaurants were on Washington Street.
Okay.
We had two side by side, right at 36 and 38 East Washington Street, between 1966 and 1986, 87.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah. And that's, you know, Greeks always go into the food industry.
Well, yeah.
You know, so the, and the food is really good. So
right.
Lots of families involved in food.
Lots of food and music. I remember being embarrassed by how my father would play Greek music driving up to school, you know, dropping me off at school with the windows down. And so I was always a little taken aback by that. But nonetheless, I'm still pretty proud of my heritage.
Yeah.
Now, the food you did bring is from Hellas Cafe, correct?
It is.
And tell us what we've got here, because there's a ton Today? Of great stuff. I mean, both desserts and
yeah.
I see a lot of pastry.
Our main course is gyros, which we have all... broken up so that it would be easy for us to eat.
And all of this is served at Greek Fest.
Mm-hmm.
This is
yeah.
all Greek
yeah,
Fest
this is all, Yeah, this is the same food that you would see
yeah.
at Greek Fest.
So.
Okay. Now, you said gyro because I just want to make sure because, you know, sometimes you hear, like, gyro.
No, it's gyro. Okay. It's a soft G, soft G-Y combination, if you will. So it is pronounced gyro, and it comes with, it's a lamb and beef combination with spices. Along with a special sauce called tzatziki sauce, which is...
That's the cucumber.
A cucumber
so
yogurt
good.
Sauce, right. And garlic. Garlic is the secret ingredient inside that. And then for dessert, we have a few pastries that are traditionally called pastas. We have a chocolate. One is called a socolatina, which is a chocolate form of the chocolate mousse cake.
No, and the ones that you wrote of those, the chocolate mousse cake, the design on top is the treble clef, the musical
right.
symbol.
Well,
why is that?
Well, because the Greeks are
it's
very lively.
Like a white icing there. Yeah.
Right. Greeks are very lively, and they love both music and food.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not by accident that you would see these things harmonized together. And then, of course, the baklava.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the walnuts and phyllo dough with just poured over with honey. Yeah, that is very good as well.
Excellent, excellent. And so, and of course, all of this will be available at Greek Fest
mm-hmm.
as well. People can get tickets the day of, ahead of time.
Yeah, the best way to buy your tickets is through this year we're introducing Marsh as our main outlet for pre-sale Greek Fest tickets. You can go to most any Marsh between downtown and the north suburbs, Carmel, Zionsville, and Fishers, and pick up pre-sale tickets at only $5. And at the door, it'll be $7. In addition, this year, we're introducing a raffle with the admission ticket. We're giving away two iPads,
mm-hmm.
One on Friday night and one on Saturday night. For all the people that want to submit a raffle ticket, and that's included in the admission ticket as a way of giving our thanks to all of our patrons.
And also, the Marsh stores are online at the website at www.indiegreekfest.org. The whole list of, you know, all the
yep.
participating Marsh stores where you can get your tickets are listed there, and there are Marsh stores all over the city, so it's very convenient,
cool.
you know, no matter where you live, to go pick up your $5 admission ticket.
Okay, so a question for both of you. Besides the food, what is it that, what's one thing that you really hope that people get to experience or see or learn about at Greek Fest? Mary Lee, I'll start with you.
Oh, I was gonna go. Dean, you go first. Well, the music. I love the music. And I love the music so much, I can't stand it. And I just hope that people really get out on the dance floor and try and dance and just...
So, I mean, sort
yeah.
of traditional Greek folk music, I mean, real high energy.
It's real high energy. These are, you know, you're going to hear music that's contemporary, but, I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's the same music that's been
oh, it's,
around.
Yes.
The same dances that have been around.
Centuries.
Centuries. the Cirto is a real popular dance. Again, I'm saying something I can pronounce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to get out there and enjoy it.
Yeah.
So.
Dean, how about you?
One of the most interesting things I think we have going on with this new location, it's our second year at this location, is our new Byzantine temple. It's a more traditional Greek-styled, mm-hmm. Greek Orthodox-styled church, and the church tours seem to have been very well received last year. And I'm really proud of the fact that we were all involved in helping build this beautiful structure.
It's an enormous building.
God. Yeah, it really, yeah. I can't remember.
Beautiful building.
Yeah.
It
Look
is.
For the big gold dome. You can't.
That's right. The new golden dome of central Indiana. anyway, it's just a magnificent structure, and we talk about our history and our faith that starts back from the times of the apostles. So I'm really proud of that. And we have something unique about our festival, I think, as opposed to others, is it is very diverse. There is, if you're a child, we'll have a new activity area that deals with arts and crafts that revolve around Greece. If you're a teen, you'll be able to, or younger, you'll be able to dance with other kids your age. And then adults, obviously we have beer and wine, assorted beer and wine for their tasting. And all the food, of course, as much as they can eat. So there's something for everyone here at our festival. Now, I would encourage those that have families, if they want to bring their kids, Saturday early in the afternoon is probably the best mm-hmm. time to come because it's less
right.
crowded.
Sure.
And so they can enjoy themselves. But if you want a lively crowd, then later on in the afternoon all the way to the evening, they'll be partying like it's like they're in Greece.
But
actually.
It's a great event for families. It's affordable, to bring your family and feed your family as well. But it's a definitely a family event, and it's always great to see a lot of kids there. But yeah, Saturday's a great day to come for lunch.
Absolutely.
I mean, get there at noon when it opens. Mm-hmm. You do avoid the lines a little bit then, but it's great no matter what
Sounds
time.
Like a plan.
Always fun. So.
Good. Well, I am looking forward to seeing you guys at Greek Fest. Mary Lee, Dean, thanks so much for coming in today, and thanks for bringing all this great food.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank
thanks
you for having
Travis.
Us.
How do we say, chow down in Greek?
Well, the more formal response would be kali oraxi, which means to enjoy your time, obviously, with your food.
Travis DiNicola with Greek Fest organizers Mary Lee Pappas and Dean Antonopoulos. The Greek Fest takes place on Friday, September 10th and Saturday, September 11th at the Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church in Carmel. More information can be found at indiegreekfest.org, indiegreekfest.org. Oh, Travis.
Yes, Sharon?
I'm so tired of working.
Have you been laboring?
I have been laboring.
Well, you know what? There's a day just for you coming up on Monday.
Really?
Yes,
what's it called?
Labor Day, Sharon.
Oh, yeah. Yay. I have to work?
Not at all.
I bet I get to do fun things.
You can.
Arts and entertainment things such as we might feature on that calendar we call What Will We Do? Labor Day
exactly.
Weekend Edition
Labor
2010.
Labor Weekend Edition. You ready?
I am. Okay, here we go. What do you have for me?
I've been checking out the stuff that's going on at the state fairgrounds. Now that the state fair is over, it doesn't mean that, the events that go on there are over. In fact, coming up in the next couple weeks, they've got harness racing, All-American Horse Classic, an antiques exposition, as a country lifestyle experience, and the Indiana Rabbit Breeder Show. So there's lots of cool stuff that is coming up at the Indiana State Fair in the next couple of weeks. In fact, every week they've got something. Just go to IndianaStateFair.com to see what's going on.
So the show is about the breeders, not the rabbits.
I'm wondering about that. I wonder if they put the breeders on exhibit.
Just picturing. And when you walk by
performance art.
When you walk by the horse stables on the east side, keep an eye out for a lovely orange stripy tomcat. I met him when I was at the state fair. He was quite friendly, and he was greeting all the crowd.
Oh, I'm sure he'll be enjoying the rabbit breeders.
I'm sure he will. Hopefully not his dinner. Speaking of food, boy, here's a segue if there ever was one. Yes, it's the Spirit and Place Food for Thought year. Yes, I do. It's so true. Help me. At Epworth United Methodist Church, They're teaming with the Heartlands Group of the Sierra Club, Hoosier Chapter, and they're doing an eco-film series this fall. This is very cool. On Friday, September 10th, it'll be at 7 o'clock at the church, which is at 6450 Allisonville Road, basically a stone's throw north of 64th and Allisonville. You can see the vanishing of the bees, and this is fascinating. Honeybees have been mysteriously disappearing from around the planet, literally vanishing from their hives. It's called colony collapse disorder. You've probably seen one or more PBS specials on our sister station, TV 20. But vanishing of the bees follows commercial beekeepers as they strive to keep their bees healthy and fulfill pollination contracts around the United States. And you can go see Vanishing of the Bees, and I'm sure there'll be a lively conversation afterwards. It's at 7 on Friday night, September 10th, at Epworth United Methodist Church.
Very cool. Hey, you probably caught the interview that I did last week with Indianapolis City Ballet, and of course, their big concert is coming up, performance is coming up on September 11th, featuring amazing ballet dancers from all over the world. The other thing that they're doing that's really cool, and we talked a little bit about in this interview, and they've just been able to release the schedule, is that they are bringing in dancers from all over the world to do master classes throughout this year for dancers in Indianapolis. And it starts on September 12th. They have dancers from American Ballet Theater, as well as the New York City Ballet, and all types of other ballets from around the world, the American Academy of Dance in Paris. We're going to be coming in at different times, starting in September all the way through next June. I would just say get the schedule if you go to IndianapolisCityBallet.org, especially if you're a dancer or have kids who are dancers. Classes are only $25 for each workshop, $10 for observers. They take place at different studios everywhere from Indiana Dance Academy, Gregory Hancock, Performers Edge, Curtain Call Dance, also even in Muncie. But go to IndianapolisCityBallet.org to get all the information.
Speaking of great performances, and by the way, make sure, look for a poster for that event, because every time there's one on the bulletin board here at FYI, and every time I see it, I have to stop and figure out, how does she do that? She's so flexible.
Oh, they're great pictures.
Yeah, they're amazing. Speaking of performances, great performances for that matter, don't forget, The World is Watching, the International Violin Competition of Indianapolis, happens only every 4 years, just like the Olympics. It's referred to sometimes as the Olympics of the violin, top prize, gold medal, and the use of an amazing fiddle for 4 years. And it's coming up. If you don't have tickets yet, go to violin.org. Yes, weren't they clever? They got in there and got that URL quickly, violin.org, for a list of venues and some of what the performers will be doing in each of the rounds.
Very, very cool. Hey, last thing that I have, I just want to mention, there's a lot of great gallery openings. If you're listening to us on Friday night, there's still time to get over to Harrison Center. That stays open till 10 tonight, including the show Harlow and the Raven King, featuring new work by Mab Graves. Really fun, fantastical storytelling type book. Also, the Urban Times Neighborhood Fair is going on there as well in the gym at Harrison Center. If you're listening Saturday, you can still check out the gallery and all the great work that's there, as well as galleries down Fountain Square and Christopher West on Mass Avenue. A lot of great galleries had big First Friday openings this weekend. Art Bank as well. And if you're laboring for more ideas of what to do, well, you'll just have to come back next week for more of
What Will We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Two high-profile chefs, two unlikely friends, two very different careers and philosophies. You can hear them share stories and muse on the place of food in our personal, community, and global life on Thursday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at Clues Memorial Hall at Butler University. Sharon Gamble found out more about An Evening with Anthony Bourdain and Eric Repair from the Indiana Humanities Council, Kira Amstutz. The Humanities Council and Spirit in Place are collaborating on a year-long exploration called Food for Thought.
Okay, so I have to ask just the big picture question, which is, it feels like we live in an era of the cult of the chef.
Does it feel like that to you, too?
Well, it does. It seems like everywhere you go, there's a different smiling celebrity chef. There's a new product they're
and
pitching.
They're all gorgeous.
There's a new show. Oh, my gosh. And flawless in their execution. Doesn't your food look like that at home, Sharon?
Yeah, sure. This is radio. I'm safe to say that. How do you think this started?
You know, I really don't know, but what's been interesting is that the public's attention on food and cooking has really, really blossomed over the last few years. And that's one of the reasons why the Humanities Council thought having this Food for Thought initiative would be a way to really maybe capture some of that interest that has developed, but take a little bit different look at it, a cultural look, a humanistic look at what does it say about us as a culture, what we eat, how we grow it, how we share it, the global practices that we have around food. We thought it was really fascinating. So I think this sort of cult of the chef and interest in food and Food Network has really kind of taken us on a journey to a really interesting topic and something that people seem to like.
I know you earlier this year had an amazing event in conjunction with the Harrison Center that had, you know, people stacked 17 deep just trying to get in up to the booth.
Right. Yeah. We were so delighted with that partnership with the Harrison Center. That event was called FoodCon, and it was part of the First Friday series. And we thought, well, we'll do a little event focused on food, and we thought that would be a great kickoff to the Food for Thought theme. Little did we know we would tap into an audience of over 2,000, and there were lots of people who couldn't even find parking places. But it was a great celebration of food, art, poetry, also kind of a trade show display of different kind of food organizations. And it gave us, again, additional motivation that we were kind of on the right track with this idea of thinking about food.
Now, because the Humanities Council is wired into so many resources, I'm picturing that you and all of your staff are constantly learning new things and getting new contexts for food and you're probably finding out that we're not alone. Indianapolis, Central Indiana, the state, we're not alone. That this nationwide, people are fascinated by food, maybe now more so than we were before the economy slowed down, because there tends to be a sensibility of slowing down, enjoying time with family more, and often that centers around the kitchen.
It does, and you're right. This isn't just an Indiana-centric trend. This is a national trend and even a global trend, which makes it sort of, again, an exciting time to be thinking about it. There are a lot of new books coming out, a lot of really interesting articles, a lot of thinkers that are spending more time on this topic. But really one of the things that we're most excited about is, although sometimes you think of this as more of a national or an international issue, so much of the progress, the thinking, the excitement is coming from here in Indiana. I mean, if you look at the last 3 years, two of the World Food Prize winners, International World Food Prize winners, were from Purdue University.
Hi.
We have brilliant chefs doing great work. We have wonderful people who are innovating in artisanal foods. We have a lot of things happening here that are really leading the nation, not only with our industry, but I think with our cultural community. And so that's why it's a really it's an exciting time to be part of this. And as a Humanities Council, we're a small office. We support a lot of work. We try to catalyze a lot of work. We convene a lot of people. But what we're really trying to do is celebrate all this great work in the food area, on food themes, that's going on all over the state with organizations big and small. So it's been really, really interesting.
And it's a great compliment to the image that we had for a long time, that I suppose we still have in some circles, that Indianapolis or pretty much any city in Indiana is a great place to try out a new chain restaurant. You know, I mean, we did have that reputation for a long time.
Well, I think we're breaking
that
mold.
Chain restaurants.
Sure, I think, yes, you know. I know there are many folks who enjoy chain restaurants, but I think we also are starting to define a bit of a niche for ourselves in more perhaps unique local food as well. So that's neat. And we're a statewide organization, so we not only get to pay attention to what's going on here in Central Indiana, but kind of the trends across the state. And I can assure you that there's a lot going on in all of the corners of the state in food and food tourism and agritourism. So if you haven't ventured out much, you need to do that.
Hit the wine trail, hit
exactly. Fair Oaks Farms, Joseph Dequi. I mean, there's just and obviously you can go to Bloomington and spend an awful lot of time eating. So there's some great places to go all over the state.
Speaking of eating, the two chefs who are coming to Clues Hall, what do they have in common and why are they paired up?
Okay, well, the two chefs you're referring to are Anthony Bourdain and Eric Repair. They're going to be at Clues Hall September 30th as part of our partnership with Spirit in Place and Indie Talks. And what's interesting about these two, and we can talk a little individually about them, but they're best friends. So one of the interesting things that you'll see, I think, is a very interesting camaraderie that they've developed over the years and interesting perspectives on each other. So this dialogue is not only going to be their unique perspective on food and culture, but also perhaps an interesting bit of insight into each other. And I imagine that might be a bit of the comical part of the presentation.
Yeah.
Maybe. Oh, well,
uh-huh.
Let's hope they reveal something. Although, if you've watched Anthony Bourdain's show, No Reservations, I'm not really sure he's left a whole lot of secrets to be revealed. He lays it all out there.
Their backgrounds are fairly different, and their training is fairly different.
Exactly. I think what I'm noticing in the Indianapolis community as people are getting really excited for this event is that especially the chefs that I know, they're like, oh, yeah, Anthony Bourdain, that'll be fine and interesting, but I really want to hear Eric Repair. And because he is he's a chef's chef. I mean, I think he really has the chops when it comes to respect in the culinary community of someone who's just an incredibly brilliant and serious chef. Anthony Bourdain will admit that although he has worn the title chef over the years, he certainly doesn't rival Eric in that kind of world. But I think what he has that's a nice complement to it is a real keen eye for observing society, understanding the role that food plays in our culture, and you know, he's a very interesting commentator, I think, on all of this stuff. His his commentary, if you listen to it on the show, is very witty, and certainly his book Kitchen Confidential kind of turned the culinary world upside down when it came out several years ago.
Because
he exposed, I think, for some. As it says on the title, the culinary underbelly.
Yeah.
and so he was very honest about, I think, what he viewed as the dysfunction in the culinary world and the types of folks attracted to it. And I think in the intervening years, he sort of tempered his opinion some, but I think what you'll always get from him is a very direct approach and it, you know, his own honest opinion, and he doesn't... he's not very
doesn't
teachy.
Sugarcoat it.
No. So I think it'd be interesting to have a dialogue with him, and the audience will have an opportunity, I think, to ask some questions, so that'll be fun.
There is a lot of drama in the world, the high-stakes world of food, or the world of high-stakes food, maybe I should say.
Oh, I think you do see that, and I think that's part of what you were mentioning earlier, what comes along with the attention and the fame. There's a lot more scrutiny, a lot more interest, and certainly a lot more competition for that almighty dollar and the attention of the public. So I think it's just par for the course.
Since your personal involvement with Food for Thought, has anything changed in your feelings about food or your approach to food? Do you and your husband both cook?
We do both cook, and we spend a lot of time around the table with our two daughters because that's the way we were raised, and it's certainly, I think, a great way to build family.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, eat well and appreciate what you eat. I also grew up in a rural area, so I grew up with a garden next door that my grandfather and uncle tended, and we canned, and we're very in touch with the food that we were eating. And I think living in a city the last 20 years, it's been a little bit more difficult for us to keep that connection with food, although I think it's much easier now with the advent of farmers markets and certainly the more urban farming you're seeing, et cetera. But I guess the other thing that I would say has changed is that although I still feel like I'm just at the tip of the iceberg, I'm learning so much more about all kinds of things that I maybe didn't realize were such important issues. I had a wonderful dialogue recently with some folks at Dow AgroSciences, and the dialogue was about how their employees are working so hard to think about how to create products that will help us feed the world. Mm. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about, I think, the tension maybe between slow food and maybe some larger agribusiness. But what we're attempting to do with Food for Thought is say, you know, there's room for all voices in this dialogue. Let's take a look at what we know and what's going on and try to learn from each other. And the thing that just was blowing me away about the work at Dow and the great work that they're doing is, you know, I think we're all united in this food dialogue about the issue of hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And how are we going to solve that as a culture? And there are a lot of great ideas, but there are a lot of really smart people working in Indiana right now on that issue. And it's exciting to know it's happening in our own backyard.
And we really are, you know, we're in the food belt. We're in the land of plenty, if you will.
We are. And, you know, again, back to the earlier point we were talking about, the innovation is happening here, and a lot of the important conversations are happening here, and we want everybody to be a part of that. You know, as a Humanities Council, it's not our role to tell people how to think. It's to encourage that process, to encourage people to think, read, talk, convene, listen, and learn. And, again, that big lesson for me throughout this process is, this was a topic I loved, I was very interested in, I do a lot of reading about food, it was a passion of mine, and there's so much more to learn. So I hope people will join us on this journey as, you know, as we've started it and join in some of the programs that we have to offer. We're doing a really fun program with storytelling. We have a traveling exhibit that's going around to communities all over the state, and part of it is a storytelling silo. And we're encouraging people to come in and tell their family food story, their personal food memory, their Indiana food story. And you get in our little booth and you record a short video, and we're collecting those, and that's going to be part of the legacy of the program.
It's StoryCorps for foodies.
It is StoryCorps for foodies.
Sharon Gamble with Kira Amstutz, President and CEO of the Indiana Humanities Council. You can experience an evening with Anthony Bourdain and Eric Repair on Thursday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at Clues Memorial Hall. Tickets are going fast, so turn up the heat and visit the Clues Hall box office or Ticketmaster soon.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli-Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4. We'll have a sample of some of our favorite interviews from this past summer.
And on Saturday from noon to 4, we'll be, you guessed it, live at Penrod.
That's right, and you can join us on the grounds of the IMA for an afternoon of live arts interviews and previews of the upcoming seasons for many arts organizations.
Plus, we'll be visiting with artists at the Penrod Arts Fair and sampling lots of food.
That's right. It all comes down to the food.
It does indeed.
So join us for Indiana's nicest day, as well as listening to us next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 for the regular broadcast of Art of the Matter.
And live from Penrod from noon to 4. That's next Saturday here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.